60 Minutes, coming up next.
America was built by people with a few dollars and a dream. And while many don't know it, there's one path to success that still only requires a dream and about $10. That's right. If your dream is to start or grow your business, something as simple as the right business card could make all the difference. And today, at Vistaprint.com, you can get 500 full-color business cards for only $9.99. That's right, only $9.99. Just go to Vistaprint.com and enter promo code 8989 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 8989.
Right here across the bridge, you can see the black flag of ISIS flying over ISIS territory.
To understand what ISIS is, where it came from, and how it blitzed through two countries, we went to the front lines to see where some of the worst atrocities in the history of terror are happening to innocents who are in ISIS's way.
We are going for you, Barack Obama.
You'll hear from the soldiers who are battling ISIS, from a family that survived an execution by crawling out of a mass grave, and from this woman, whose sisters and mother have vanished.
Tell them I just want my mother.
What's being done to defeat the men who ride under the black flag? That's our story tonight.
Was this like a community of people doing this?
More like a nation of people doing this.
He's talking about a scam so simple you think it would never work. But for years now, people like Corey Williams have been filing bogus tax returns in order to collect billions of dollars in fraudulent refunds.
By the year 2016, IRS will be hemorrhaging and losing $21 billion due to this type of fraud.
It's only 2014. Don't you think something can be done in the next 2 years to fix this?
Well, that is my hope.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Bill Whitaker.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on the 47th season premiere of 60 Minutes. Today, America's top military officer, General Martin Dempsey, said the U.S. and its allies will attack ISIS from many directions. We want them to wake up every day, realizing they're being squeezed, he said. American pilots have hit the Islamic extremist group in Iraq nearly 200 times now, and soon the U.S. will be bombing ISIS in Syria. America was drawn back into war when ISIS began to overrun part of northern Iraq called Kurdistan. Kurdistan is semi-autonomous with its own military called the Peshmerga. With American air support, the Peshmerga are holding a tense front line against ISIS. Earlier this month, we started our reporting on that front line to explain ISIS, what it is, where it came from, and how it blitzed through two countries. In June, the leader of ISIS declared himself ruler of a new nation, which he calls the Islamic State.
Of course, no country on earth recognizes that state, but if it had a border, this would be it. These are Kurdish Peshmerga forces in northern Iraq, and right here across the bridge, you can see the black flag of ISIS flying over ISIS territory.
All Muslims know what's written there in Arabic. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his messenger. But the true meaning of this banner is written in blood. And it's up to another Muhammad, First Lieutenant Hazar Muhammad, to make sure the flag never crosses this bridge. Why is this bridge so important? This is the road to Kirkuk, he told us. The city of Kirkuk is 10 miles behind us, and it's the gateway to Iraq's northern oil fields.
Do you have orders to destroy this bridge if it comes to that?
No, Mohammed said. The people need this bridge. No one's going to take my bridge. But he couldn't have said that last month. In August, the Peshmerga were falling back, just 25 miles from their capital city, Erbil. The U.S. had stayed out of it for 2.5 years, but panicked leaders of Kurdistan called the White House, and that's what triggered the airstrikes.
You were outgunned.
We were outgunned, yes.
Mesrour Barzani knows ISIS better than just about anyone. He's head of Kurdish intelligence and the Kurdistan Regional Security Council.
I think everybody underestimated the strength of ISIS, especially with all the weapons that they seized from Syrian army and Iraqi army. Five Iraqi divisions melted away, and you know, they just left their weapons, which fell into the hands of ISIS.
Weapons bought by American taxpayers were captured by ISIS as it paraded into cities that had been won by American troops.
How many ISIS fighters are there?
There are perhaps 40,000 ISIS fighters who are carrying guns, fighting both in Iraq and Syria, maybe equally divided in two countries.
And how many people collaborating with them?
Well, collaborating, whether they believe in helping them or not, or out of fear, I would say over 100,000.
Where does ISIS get its money?
They generate their own revenues, and based on the information that we have, they generate something equivalent to $6 million daily by the selling of oil, wheat, taking taxes from people, ransoms, and still getting donations.
You talked about donations.
Many people who believe in these extremist ideologies believe that it's their duty to donate money to this organization.
And that's been coming from where?
Different countries, actually.
In the Gulf states?
Some in the Gulf states.
$6 million a day, that'll keep them going forever.
If they're not stopped.
U.S. airstrikes have stopped the advance, but black flags fly from northern Syria to Mosul, one of Iraq's largest cities. Now, more than 4.5 million people are ruled by something new, a 7th-century vision with 21st-century reach. In digital depravity, ISIS uploads its atrocities to strike fear far beyond the range of its guns. The beheadings of two Americans and a Briton were calculated to give ISIS global stature, and it worked. Massacres on YouTube, the slaughter of thousands, are designed to defeat resistance ahead of the advance.
We are going for you, Barack Obama.
Its sophisticated media department uploads recruiting videos in a host of languages.
There's a role for everybody. Every person can contribute something to the Islamic State.
Gunmen with cameras magnify the menace to make ISIS appear larger than life. But what ISIS has shown only once is its leader. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi appeared in July when he called on all of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims to bow to him.
We should be very careful about underestimating him. This guy is the real deal.
Derek Harvey was in Iraq for the beginnings of al-Baghdadi. A colonel in U.S. Army intelligence, he briefed President Bush and top commanders. Back then, Baghdadi was a member of al-Qaeda in Iraq and was imprisoned for a time by U.S. forces. When Iraq's al-Qaeda leader was killed, Baghdadi took over.
When he became a key figure within the organization, he was targeted, and then in 2010, he had a $10 million bounty put on his head and became a top-tier target.
But the target slipped away into Syria, where he used the chaos of the civil war to build his army. He began to refuse orders from al-Qaeda, and in February, al-Qaeda's leader kicked him out.
What does al-Baghdadi want?
He wants power, influence, and authority, and a return to the prestige of the Islamic community. And he's going to start with Syria and Iraq, and his strategic vision is to expand into the Gulf, Jordan, from the Mediterranean to Pakistan.
Baghdadi preaches Salafism. It is a tiny sect in Islam that calls for a return to the origins of the faith 1,400 years ago. But Baghdadi's interpretation injects lethal prejudice. Under ISIS, those who reject Salafism are non-believers, subject to execution. That applies to fellow Muslims and their mosques. And it applies especially to non-Muslims.
What happened in your village when ISIS came in?
They told us, wave the white flag. We won't harm you. You'll be free to go.
Nadia lived with her large family, including brothers Saeed and Khalid, in a village of Yazidis, a non-Muslim ethnic group in Iraq. She asked us not to show you her face, and when you hear her story, you'll understand why.
They had told us you have until Sunday to convert. But before Sunday, they came back and said, we have been told you will not convert, so you are not forgiven. So we were all taken to the school. There, the women and kids were put upstairs and the men downstairs.
In August, in a scene similar to this, the men were loaded onto trucks and told they were headed to a refugee camp. But like these men, it turned out to be a short ride to a mass grave. Nadia's brothers, Saeed and Khalid, were on the trucks.
After taking us about 300 yards away from the school, they stopped by an open field and told us to get out and lay flat on your stomach, and we did. Then, after we laid flat, about 10 ISIS fighters stood behind us and started firing all types of guns.
One by one, they said, no survivors. If any survivors, they would come around and shoot them in the head. They shot us with all types of guns. I was shot 5 times.
Twice in the knee, once in the thigh, once in the back, and a graze to the neck. From a window in the school where the women were being held, a boy could see it all.
What did the little boy say?
He said, I saw through the window they're killing the men. I saw from a distance. But we didn't want to believe him. We said he's just a little boy. He might just be seeing things. We didn't believe him.
Do you have any idea how many men were killed in that massacre?
I think about 380.
And how many survivors?
10 to 12.
He told us as the ISIS fighters were finishing off the victims, a plane flew overhead and scared them away. He and his brother, who'd been shot 3 times, crawled out of the mass grave.
After the shooting stopped, what happened to the women? What happened to you?
They told us to come downstairs. They took our IDs, phones, our gold. They even ripped the gold earrings out of some of the kids' ears. ISIS used the local villagers' trucks, started loading up 16 to 20 women at a time and taking us away. The final destination was a little town.
And when you got there, what happened?
There was someone at the front door. He would take off our headscarves and rip open the front of our dresses. And he would touch us, sexually abuse us.
Later, Nadia was imprisoned in a house where, she says, women were given away as prizes.
The very next morning, a sheikh from Tel Afar came and picked up 3 girls for himself. 2 were my friends. He had the right to take 3, and an ISIS militant had the right to take 1. A friend of mine, who was taken by an ISIS commander and returned, had told us, they're doing everything they please with us, raping us, sexually abusing us, and that the ISIS men would tell them, if you do not convert, we will rape you all and sell you all to ISIS militants in Syria, where a young girl could be sold for about $800.
When she heard that, Nadia took advantage of a blackout and escaped from the building. Now, all the family has of life before ISIS is this video of the wedding of a friend. Hard to watch. They told us nearly everyone in the video is dead.
What about the other members of your family?
My sisters, 2 of them whom I speak with at times, who somehow snuck a phone through, have no idea where our mother is. I don't know anything regarding my mother. Tell them, I want my mother. My friends are captive. I have no idea where my other brothers are. I want them all to return, but most of all, I just want my mother. Tell them, I just want my mother.
How was the Black Banner carried so far? A third of Iraq gone in a matter of weeks. ground hard won by the United States in what was known as Operation Iraqi Freedom.
The American people sacrificed 4,475 lives, 10 years, and $1 trillion building a government and an army for Iraq. How did all of that crumble so fast?
It's a tragic story.
Leon Panetta was defense secretary when the U.S. walked off the Iraqi stage in 2011.
Back when you watched the Stars and Stripes being lowered for the last time in Baghdad, were you confident in that moment that pulling out was the right thing to do?
No, I wasn't. I really thought that it was important for us to maintain a presence in Iraq. The decision was that we ought to at least try to maintain 8,000 to 10,000 U.S. troops there, plus keeping some of our intelligence personnel in place to be able to continue the momentum in the right direction. And frankly, having those troops there, I think, would have given us greater leverage on Maliki to try to force him to do the right thing as well.
Nouri al-Maliki was the elected prime minister. He didn't want the U.S. troops. A paranoid man of the Shia sect of Islam, he nursed a grudge against the Sunni branch of the faith. He'd been a thorn in America's side for 8 years. President Bush, in an off-camera conversation with us in 2007, said, "That Maliki is a son of a bitch, but we have to deal with him."
Prime Minister Maliki, who had the opportunity to kind of hold all of this together, just turned on the Sunnis, fed into the historical sectarian divisions that have marked that country for centuries, and basically undercut and undermined the security force in Iraq and created, I think, the very ingredients that led to what we see today in Iraq.
Maliki, in your estimation, dismantled what we built, took the Sunni military officers out and replaced them with Shias.
We gave them a chance. I mean, you know, nobody can guarantee that Iraq would be able to go in the right direction. But we gave him a chance. We gave him the tools. But instead, he turned to vengeance, and vengeance never pays off.
But it paid off for ISIS. ISIS conquered with a relatively small force because it was welcomed by the oppressed Sunnis in Iraq. In an austere intelligence agency lockup, we met the kind of man who joined ISIS. We didn't know what to expect. But it turned out he wasn't a young fanatic. He was a middle-aged real estate agent from Mosul, one of the fed-up Sunnis.
When ISIS first came in, did people support them? Were they welcome?
The army was hurting people. Even the governor and the local government were hurting people. People thought something good was going to happen. They thought there was going to be an Islamic State, a caliphate, that they would help people and rid them of oppression.
Then they learned what the black flag really meant.
You either join them or they would consider you an infidel.
And what did that mean to you?
If they declared you an infidel, that means they kill you.
President Obama refused to engage in a new campaign until Iraq dumped Nouri al-Maliki. Well, 2 weeks ago, a new prime minister took office, promising to unite his people. But first, he'll have to get his country back. In a moment, the advice Mr. Obama got 2 years ago that might have headed off ISIS.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
America was built by people with a few dollars and a dream. And while many don't know it, there's one path to success that still only requires a dream and about $10. That's right. If your dream is to start or grow your business, something as simple as the right business card could make all the difference. And today, at Vistaprint.com, you can get 500 full-color business cards for only $9.99. That's right, only $9.99. Just go to Vistaprint.com and enter promo code 8989 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 8989.
President Obama's plan hinges on arming and training moderate Syrian militias to defeat ISIS. The president has been criticized for not doing that sooner. You're about to hear from two men who saw the threat early. former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, and Abdullah II, the King of Jordan. Jordan is a moderate American ally nearly surrounded by war, with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to its west, Syria to its north, and Iraq to the east. Today, we spoke to King Abdullah in New York before this month's UN General Assembly meeting. For hundreds of years, his family ruled the holiest shrines in Islam, and the king was nearly at a loss for words today when we asked him about the head of ISIS, who claims to lead all Muslims.
I hate to use the word heretics or whatever the words of those types are, but to even call himself a Muslim to me is just the words that I just particularly don't want to use on this program.
You just used the word heretic. Is he an Islamic heretic?
I think to use the word Islam and him in the same sentence is not acceptable. That he even speaks in the name of Islam for me is just so horrendous and so shocking.
The Kingdom of Jordan has borne the burden of the Syrian civil war, even though it has no oil wealth and precious little water. We went to the border where for 3 years refugees from that war have risked death in the desert in the hope of reaching Jordan where they're welcome. We caught up with this group of refugees inside Syria as they made the last mile to the berm that marks the border with Jordan. There are hundreds just like them every day, thousands every month. Jordan is now host to vast refugee camps which have become cities in the desert.
It's the right thing to do. I mean, where else would the Syrians go? They're in dire straits. And that's why today we have 1.4 million Syrian refugees in our country, 20% or slightly more of our population.
20% of the population?
Yes.
Are refugees from outside the country?
Equivalent of probably 60 million refugees in your country as we speak.
How long can you manage that?
Well, I think we're at the limit, actually, and with the difficult economic conditions that we're in, it's a tremendous burden on our country.
Have your troops been engaged with ISIS? Do you think of your borders as secure?
We have retaliated to several contacts over the past several months to those that have come across our border or try to come across our border. So we have been I think somewhat aggressive to make sure that our borders are defended.
Are your borders secure?
Our borders are extremely secure.
King Abdullah told us forcing ISIS out of Iraq is the easier part, but he estimates digging it out of its base in eastern Syria could take 2 years. He supports U.S. airstrikes as essential to overpowering ISIS.
The difference with ISIS, I think, compared to any other organization is their self-financing. They can produce within a year, in a year cycle, up to almost $1 billion worth of oil derivatives that they're obviously selling at a low price, about $30 a barrel, which means that they can pay a lot of foreign fighters to come into their country. They can buy weapons.
Would $1 billion a year give them a seat at OPEC?
You would imagine if you had that capability, which is, I think, about what they have today is about a third of the production of the United Arab Emirates. You know, in a way, technically, they'd be asking for a seat at OPEC.
Now, according to the king, all countries in the region face a choice.
ISIS, I think, has triggered an understanding that it's time for all of us to make up our minds on the fight of good against evil. And this brings all of us together from all religions of all different sides of the divide to make up our minds, are we going to fight the good fight?
Could the rise of ISIS have been prevented?
They could have been prevented if the international community worked harder together to make sure that funding and support to the original groups in Syria were not allowed to get to the extent that they were.
The international community, the United States, intervened too late.
I think we could have done a better job in making sure that earlier on it was identified who the bad people were and action by the international community was taken not to allow that to happen.
It turns out President Obama was urged to intervene in Syria much earlier. In a new book, Worthy Fights, former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta writes that in a meeting in the fall of 2012, he, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the director of the CIA, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs all urged the president to arm moderate Syrians who had started the revolution against the dictatorship to begin with. That might have left no room for ISIS to grow.
The real key was, how can we develop a leadership group among the opposition that would be able to take control? And my view was, to have leverage to do that, we would have to provide the weapons and the training in order for them to really be willing to work with us in that effort.
But with virtually his entire national security team unanimous on this, that's not the decision the president made.
I think the president's concern, and I understand it, was that he had a fear that if we started providing weapons, we wouldn't know where those weapons would wind up. My view was, you have to begin somewhere.
In retrospect now, was not arming the rebels at that time a mistake?
I think that would have helped. And I think in part we paid a price for not doing that in what we see happening with ISIS.
We will increase our support.
Now ISIS has forced Mr. Obama to reverse himself. The new policy depends on local forces to win on the ground. But many of the available partners are dubious. Syrian rebels fight each other, and the Pentagon figures only about half the Iraqi army is reliable. But at the same time, ISIS has problems of its own. Its advance is running into heavy opposition now. In the north, we found Kurdish troops holding the line backed by U.S. airstrikes.
Thank you, America.
Thank you.
Thank you, Obama. Thank you, American military.
To the east and south, ISIS has come up against the opposing Shia population. Most of Baghdad is Shia. If ISIS has reached its borders, the concern for America now is, what will ISIS export?
When we see these ISIS soldiers on these videos say, "We're coming for you, America," but is that idle boasting, or are they a threat here at home?
I think they are a threat. I think they're as dangerous, as fanatical, as terrorist, as Al-Qaeda was. And they have a large number of foreign fighters with foreign passports that make them particularly dangerous to the safety of this country.
How long does it take to destroy ISIS?
I think it's going to take a long time. And I think the American people need to know it's going to take a long time.
It's been a long time already. U.S. forces attacked Iraq in 1991 and were engaged on the ground or in the air for 21 years.
There it is.
The latest effort begins where Lieutenant Mohammed is holding the bridge to Kirkuk. Each American campaign began like a journey on a bridge, straight, narrow, clearly defined, until it reached the enemy.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
America was built by people with a few dollars and a dream. And while many don't know it, there's one path to success that still only requires a dream and about $10. That's right. If your dream is to start or grow your business, something as simple as the right business card could make all the difference. And today, at Vistaprint.com, you can get 500 full-color business cards for only $9.99. That's right, only $9.99. Just go to Vistaprint.com and enter promo code 8989 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 8989.
There have been lots of stories over the past few months on identity theft and how the information can be used against you. You may have heard something about stolen identity tax fraud. You may even have been a victim of it. It's the biggest tax scam around now. This is how it works. Someone steals your identity, files a bogus tax return in your name before you do, and collects a refund check from the IRS. It's so simple, you would think it would never work, but it does. It's been around since 2008, and you'd think the IRS would have come up with a way to stop it. It hasn't. Instead, the scam's gone viral, tripling in the past 3 years. The IRS estimates that it sent out nearly 3 million fraudulent refunds to con artists last year. And according to a new report from the Government Accountability Office out tomorrow, it cost taxpayers $5.2 billion. The Treasury Department believes the numbers are much higher than that. proving once again what every con man already knows. There is no underestimating the general dysfunction and incompetence of government bureaucracy.
It's a tsunami of fraud that we have been encountering. Mm-hmm. The vast number of fraudulent tax returns was something that I don't think the IRS ever really was ready for.
Wilfredo Ferrer is the United States Attorney for Southern Florida, and George Pirro, the agent in charge of the Miami field office of the FBI. Together, they run a federal task force operating at the epicenter of the largest tax scam in the country.
Florida has been third year in a row on the top, number one, in terms of ID theft complaints. And Miami is also number one in terms of metropolitan areas that suffer from identity fraud.
Mm-hmm. Don't take this the wrong way. Is there any scheme that Miami is not number one at?
We have very sophisticated and good criminals, Steve, who know how to you know, defeat the system.
For decades now, South Florida has been the Silicon Valley for scam artists, drawn here by the weather, the beaches, and the opportunity to make lots of money without actually doing much work. There's Medicare fraud, mortgage fraud, and now what the Justice Department calls stolen identity tax refund fraud, a tax preparation scheme epitomized by an overabundance of questionable-looking establishments that have sprung up here over the past few years. But this scam is so easy, you don't even need an office.
For this fraud, all you need is a laptop, someone's Social Security number, date of birth, not even their name. They can do it from their kitchen table, they can do it at a fast food chain restaurant, or they can do it on the beach as long as they have Wi-Fi access.
Actually, Corey Williams says you don't even need a laptop. You can file phony returns on your cell phone if you have the right app. He used to be a legitimate tax preparer until his boss turned him onto the scam. Before he was arrested and sentenced to 40 months in prison, he'd made millions and millions of dollars.
Anybody who knew about it, you'd be a fool to not try to get involved with making some money. I could wake up in the comfort of my own home and just get on a laptop, do about 15 returns a day, 15 times $3,000 a return, that's $45,000 a day.
So you had a home office?
Yeah, I used to work in... I would work in my boxes and the T-shirt. Yeah.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. Williams gave us a demonstration. 1, you collect or buy a list of stolen identities that are readily available in Miami if you know the right people. 2, you go to one of dozens of tax preparation sites online, and using the stolen Social Security numbers and dates of birth, you fill out a completely bogus W-2 form claiming a modest refund of a few thousand dollars.
It has given us a refund of $4,834.
3, you tell the IRS if you want the refund mailed to your house, wired to your bank account, or loaded onto a prepaid debit card.
Do you have any idea how many bogus returns you filled out?
It has to be like in the thousands.
Did the IRS pay all of them?
On a percentage range, you'd say they would pay out 40% of the tax returns.
Once you hit the send button, how long did it take you to get a check?
7 days.
7 days?
Yes.
So you'd send in these returns, and 7 days later, you'd get a check?
Yes.
40% of the time?
40% of the time.
Where would you have them send the check?
You could send the checks to an address, any address. I've seen cases where 25 checks came to one address, and the mailman delivered it.
It sounded so outrageous, we wanted to run it by the federal task force.
So you just put down a name and a Social Security number and you could make up an employer or the amount of money that was earned and withheld.
That's
and
it.
Send it off to the IRS, and they'll send you a check back for the refund?
They will pay most of the time unless they catch that there's some fraudulent, you know, information, and then it's our job to chase.
I'm still amazed that you don't need to provide any documentation when you file your tax return.
There are no supporting documents when you're filing electronically. And that's the ease or the convenience that was created for the benefit of the innocent taxpayer, which is now being exploited by criminals.
You would think that the IRS computers would notice that they were sending thousands of checks to a handful of addresses, but they didn't. And you might expect that the IRS would match taxpayer returns with legitimate W-2 forms filed by employers. It doesn't do that either, because the law requires refund checks to be sent out within 6 weeks,
and employer W-2s are often not available until months later. So if a bogus return is received before a legitimate one, the check will go out to the crooks.
The way that you learn that you become a victim of this is when you go in and try to file your return and the IRS tells you, oh, you've already filed. You're like, no, I haven't. I'm like, yes, you have. Well, it wasn't you. It was the fraudster who used your identity to file the return.
And it's not an easy problem to get fixed. Many of the people in this line outside the IRS office in Plantation, Florida, are victims of the fraud, waiting to prove their identity and claim their rightful refund. They will eventually be reimbursed, but it can involve massive amounts of paperwork, multiple visits to the office, and months of waiting.
And this is where I call the sort of the nightmarish process of clearing up your identity. I have seen cases of individuals who have almost lost their businesses because they did not get the refund check in time. I've seen individuals who have almost lost their place at a nursing home because they needed that refund to pay for that year's worth of services. And it's a real shame. It's a real shame.
Did you know about this before you got this job?
I had no idea about this before I started getting briefed last fall.
John Koskinen is the commissioner of the IRS, its fourth commissioner in just 2 years. It's become a high turnover position in part because the agency has been beset by a number of embarrassing problems, including stolen identity tax fraud, that have led people to question its competency.
I mean, it looks to me like the IRS got really outsmarted by some people who were not all that bright or not all that ingenious.
What happened was a lot of people discovered that, A, Social Security numbers are either easy to steal or find or buy, and then, B, you could file a false return.
Why didn't anybody anticipate that?
Well, I think it goes back to the fact that people didn't anticipate Social Security numbers were going to be so readily available. The assumption was, until very recently, that a Social Security number was a part of your identity that you protected and took great care of. So that no one actually ever expected that those would be easy to get a hold of.
But there were plenty of warnings. The Senate Finance Committee held hearings on stolen identity refund fraud way back in 2009, when then IRS Commissioner Douglas Shulman testified.
I discussed the issue of identity theft with the senior leaders at the IRS my first day on the job.
There were more hearings in 2011 and another in 2012 with Deputy IRS Commissioner Steve Miller.
We cannot stop all identity theft. However, we are better than we were, and we will get better still.
In those ensuing years, the number of cases of stolen identity refund fraud have risen from 51,000 to nearly 3 million.
In the year 2012, the Department of Treasury's Inspector General predicted that by the year 2016, IRS will be hemorrhaging and losing $21 billion due to this type of fraud.
It's only 2014. Don't you think something can be done in the next 2 years to fix this?
Well, that is my hope.
But it will not be easy. The entire IRS system uses Social Security numbers as its primary means of identifying taxpayers, even though they're now ubiquitous in public, private, and corporate files, just waiting to be stolen by thieves.
The key to this is to have somebody in the inside or someone who has access to our Social Security numbers, to our date of birth. And a lot of these individuals are insiders in big institutions, in banks, hospitals, schools, clinics.
We would approach anyone who worked at like a dental office, anybody who worked in a medical field. You would just approach them. You tell them if they get you 100 names, you would give them $1,000.
These people easy to find in Miami?
Very easy. Very easy.
As you would think, if you went in and started knocking doors and asking people that worked at hospitals and doctors' offices and dentists' offices, somebody would call the cops.
No, they needed the money more than they wanted to call the cops. Everybody was with it. Everybody was with the scam.
Was this like a community of people doing this?
More like a nation of people doing this.
It's gone from hundreds of people filing hundreds of fraudulent returns to thousands of people filing millions of fraudulent returns. And it's become much more organized. U.S. Attorney Ferrer says some people are even setting up franchises.
We have had defendants, masterminds of these schemes, engage in filing parties. And what they do is that they invite their friends to a hotel room or to an apartment, and then they tell them how to do it in return for a cut of these tax returns.
You make it sound like Amway or Tupperware.
That's what we've seen.
Even Ferrer's own boss, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, has had his identity stolen in an IRS refund scam. And a number of members of the task force have been victimized, including North Miami Beach police officer Rocky Festa, who says local police departments have been hit hard.
Aventura had nearly their entire department, which was 50-some-odd officers, got hit. Davie Fire and Davie Police, it was in the hundreds. They were all victims of tax return fraud.
Festa and his partner, Craig Caitlin, now work exclusively on tax refund cases and were among the first to discover the breadth of the scam 5 years ago when they began finding tax documents and stacks of prepaid debit cards when they pulled over suspicious vehicles.
Here's a wire plastic with the card.
You can get one of these prepaid debit cards almost anywhere, usually without providing identification. You then deposit and withdraw money from it as needed. It's like a bank account for people who don't have one.
Now, is that a Visa, a real Visa card?
It's a real Visa card.
And you can can go into a convenience store and buy a Visa card?
Right off the shelf.
If you want, the IRS will electronically deposit tax refunds directly onto these cards, no questions asked, eliminating the need for crooks to ever actually set foot inside a bank or to try and cash a refund check. They can spend the money in stores or withdraw it from ATMs.
So is this kind of like a throwaway phone?
Yes, sir. Yeah, once the money goes on the card, you empty the money off on ATMs and you put the card in the garbage. It's pretty good.
The prepaid cards are now used by millions of Americans to collect $142 billion in government entitlements, like Social Security and Medicare payments. IRS Commissioner Koskinen thinks it's an invitation to commit fraud.
The prepaid cards are the currency of criminals. Our problem is you can't distinguish the number of a prepaid card from a legitimate bank account.
Almost impossible to trace, right?
It is almost impossible to trace.
Why doesn't somebody put an end to that?
There are a significant percentage of the population unbanked, as it were called. Because if you don't allow them to use a prepaid card, they're going to have to get a check, and they'll have to pay somebody a lot of money to cash that check. So you're disadvantaging a significant part of the population.
And empowering a criminal network.
And you're empowering a criminal network.
5 years into the scam, the IRS can still not always tell if the person filing the return and claiming the refund is actually the real taxpayer. By comparison, the credit card companies are much better at flagging suspicious charges before they're paid out.
Credit card companies don't have that much of a problem with this. Why can't the IRS do that?
So that's the direction in which we're going. It's a significant move into what I call the 21st century. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of in the late 1900s. But this is still a big problem that we have. While we're making great progress, we've got a lot of work to do.
IRS Commissioner Koskinen says the agency does catch a lot of the fraud, but the enforcement efforts have been hampered by cuts to its budget. A number of fixes are under consideration, some of them obvious, including delaying the payment of refund checks until they can be matched up with W-2 forms filed by employers. The House passed legislation recently increasing the penalties for tax refund fraud, and the Senate Finance Committee has scheduled yet another round of hearings.
As we prepare to open 60 Minutes' 47th year, we got to thinking about the topics and people who preoccupied us during that first season in 1968. It was an election year and a time of turmoil for a nation tired of war abroad and repelled by violence at home. No figure dominated that autumn like candidate Richard Milhouse Nixon. He appeared on 60 Minutes twice that fall and told Mike Wallace, style and charisma aren't what make a good president.
Some public men are destined to be loved, and other public men are destined to be disliked. But the most important thing about a public man is not whether he's loved or disliked, but whether he's respected. And I hope to restore respect to the presidency.
Nixon went on to win the presidency that November, only to leave it in disgrace 6 years later. I'm Leslie Stahl. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.